This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Spring, it's here. You can feel it in the air. But there is always something, isn't there? And with warmer weather, one of those somethings is ticks. Cases of Lyme disease here have more than doubled, just Lyme disease in general, have more than doubled in the last 30 years. Today, about 300,000 to 400,000 people get infected with the tick-borne illness each year, most of them here in the Northeast. Now, in a few minutes, we are going to speak with a tick-borne illness expert who specializes in Lyme disease. So call us with your Lyme disease questions. Do you want to know how to avoid it? How to identify it? Have you had a Lyme disease experience? Maybe you found a tick and you don't know what to do. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. But first, Tom Keene is a former Boston City Councilor. He's a freelance writer for local publications such as The Globe and WBUR's Cognoscenti, and he found out the hard way that some signs of Lyme disease can be easily missed. He joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on.
So, Tom, you do not have Lyme disease now. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. How long did you have it? And tell us about your symptoms.
Sure. So I actually don't know how long I had it. The suspicion is that I contracted it with a tick bite sometime last summer. But while most people are familiar with the fact that you have this kind of bullseye on your skin from the tick, I had nothing like that. And what I actually noticed is that in the fall, I was getting short of breath. I found that I couldn't climb even the slightest hill. I had no idea what was going on with me. So I eventually just go into the hospital. I'm figuring, oh, maybe I just have like low-grade pneumonia or something like that. I tell them I'm out of breath. And then all of a sudden, for the next 3 days, they're thinking I'm having a major cardiac event. And in fact, that major cardiac event was something called heart block. The electrical signals to my heart were getting blocked. And the reason they were getting blocked was that I had Lyme disease. The Lyme bacteria kind of set up shop around my heart, interfere with the electrical signals. And while the doctors are saying, we're going to have to put you on a pacemaker, and you know, this is a really serious issue, all of a sudden, one doctor at Mass General says, you know, this could be Lyme disease. And I said, no, it can't be Lyme disease. I don't have Lyme disease. I've never contracted it. He tests for it. Sure enough, I have it. I go on a 3-week course of intravenous antibiotics and I'm cured.
Amazing. All right. So there's a couple things in there. One, this heart condition that you presented with, that's not a particularly typical symptom of Lyme disease, correct?
That's correct. It's technically called, I believe, Lyme carditis. And it is very, very rare, which is why it wasn't the first thing on people's minds when I went into the hospital.
And did you ever even remember, like, did you ever find a tick on you last summer? Or is this a complete mystery when and how this might have happened?
I have a dog, so of course I blame the dog. And the dog certainly gets ticks. I was unaware that one had bitten me. But I figure a walk in the woods, a walk on the beach or something like that, and that's probably how I got it.
And what was this threshold that went from, you know, I can imagine people thinking at home, wow, I get short of breath. Do I need to go to the ER? Was there a moment where you were finally like, this is not normal. This is not fatigue. And I guess, go.
Yeah, so it was really funny. It crept up on me so slowly that it's only in retrospect that I realized how bad off I was, because it wasn't a sudden precipitating event. I was finding myself waking up at night, like feeling like I couldn't breathe or something was wrong. And honestly, it was, it's a Saturday. I'm sitting down at the breakfast table with my wife saying, this is getting really weird. And she said, well, we're not busy today. Let's just go into the emergency room and see what's going on. And it was really almost as casual as that.
Okay. So what would you say to other people who are sitting at home and saying, okay, I don't have some bullseye rash, but am I sick?
I think as I learn more about it, my number one lesson to people is don't do what I did and try to ignore symptoms. If you feel that something is off, ask your doctor about it. As you noted at the top of the show, Lyme disease is really a New England phenomenon. There are 300,000 to 400,000 cases a year. And if you catch the case in time, and this is the most important thing, if you catch it in time, antibiotics actually will kill the bacteria and stop the disease in its tracks. If you don't catch it in time, that's when we hear all the stories about people who have persistent Lyme disease. The bacteria basically just spread throughout the body, damaging other parts of your body, and that damage is extremely hard to undo.
So I just want to note for listeners, in a couple of minutes, we'll bring on a tick-borne illness disease specialist who can tell us a little bit more about that. Tom, it struck me in reading the piece you wrote about this in the Boston Globe that once you started the course of antibiotics, you just got better.
Literally in a day. And it was actually quite amazing. My heart was, the arrhythmia was really obvious to my doctors. One evening at Mass Ave, I took my first intravenous course. In the morning, they checked and they said, oh yeah, you're pretty good.
Wow.
And I was discharged that day and went home, and I actually did the IV course at home. That's the other thing to note. It's not like you have to go into the hospital or do it on an outpatient basis. You can administer it yourself. They put a little port in your body. You administer the drugs once a day, and it got down to maybe a 10 or 15 minute process.
All right. So have you changed the way you go for walks? Do you check for ticks when you get back, that kind of thing now?
Well, it turns out that you can actually buy clothing that is tick repellent, and particularly socks. And so I actually did buy those, and I wear those whenever I go out into a woods or anything like that.
I'm thinking Mother and Father's Day present for lots of people out there now. Okay, Tom Keene, freelance writer for local publications such as The Globe and WBUR's Cognoscenti, former Boston City Councilor. Glad you're okay. Thanks for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure.
So we will take your questions. Have you had experience with Lyme disease? Do you have questions about how to protect yourself? How do I know if I'm sick with Lyme disease? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Dr. Sam Donta joins us now. He is a retired University of Connecticut professor of medicine and infectious disease at Boston Medical Center. Clinician specializing in Lyme disease research, he continues to advise committees on both local and federal level on matters having to do with Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. Welcome, Dr. Donta.
Thank you.
First, I know you heard Tom tell his story there. Your reactions?
I think what's fortunate about Mr. Keene's illness is that it demanded attention. He couldn't really go on, so he, at some point, needed to go to the emergency room or see his doctor. And I'm sure they did a cardiogram right away and noticed the block. And then I guess filled in the history, or at some point was able to determine that that block might be due to Lyme disease. As he mentioned, it's not a very common presentation, probably less than 5 to 7% of all cases of Lyme disease, but it can be very life-threatening as well. He could have passed out, and depending on the degree, and he had complete heart block. The other thing about his case, carditis usually happens within the first 2 to 3 months after tick exposure, and it is readily treatable, as he indicated. So he was fortunate to be able to go to a place where they recognized it, treated him promptly, and it does sound like he probably has been cured of Lyme disease.
So we have lots of calls coming in, and in just a minute, I'm going to turn to the phones. But before I do, I noticed when you were responding to Tom's story, you said his symptoms demanded attention. And that made me think that you were thinking there can be Lyme disease symptoms that don't, and you might miss or not know that you have the disease. Does that happen very often?
Unfortunately, it does. As he mentioned, there are a number of people who don't know that they've had a tick bite that has caused a rash. It's called a bullseye rash, which happens to occur in really just about half the people. So even though originally in the Lyme disease recognition era, it goes back to the 80s, it was thought that 80 to 90% of people had the rash, but that was who presented. And the problem is that there are so many people who get bit, and if you don't have a rash and you start to have these non-specific symptoms, what Mr. Keene had was what we call an objective sign. That is something that you could see, in this case, the cardiogram. If you have a Bell's palsy, where you get paralysis of the seventh nerve, so that the side of your face and your lip goes down. That's also an objective sign. But many, if not most of the people, end up having an illness characterized as, oh, I'm tired, I'm achy. It'd be great if you had arthritis, which is another objective sign. And it was the early manifestation or recognized manifestation of a Lyme disease. And in those people, their tests were positive. It's the other majority of the people, as it turns out, who end up in a chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia type of illness, and the doctors have a hard time understanding, why is this patient here? I have all of these nonspecific symptoms. And in that case, the blood tests are not as clear as we'd like them to be. So it makes a problem diagnostically, and then treatment becomes more difficult the longer you've had the symptoms.
So that is concerning, and I will come back to that. I do want to grab a couple of phone calls, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jordan's on the line in Dorchester. Jordan, go ahead.
Hi. So I actually caught Lyme disease once, like just right in the middle of the city. I was on a date, and we were sitting in the grass in Mission Hill, and I didn't realize that I got bitten by a tick, and then a few days later, I saw the rash on my leg, but I didn't think it was a bullseye. I thought it was like ringworm. So I went to the doctor and they were like, nope, that looks like Lyme. You're on antibiotics now.
And they worked.
I guess we caught it early enough.
They worked, Jordan.
Yeah, it worked.
All right. Thanks for that call. We'll also pick up Greg here in Boston. Greg, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question for the doctor is, do we know how close we are to a vaccine for the tick illness? It feels like it's been forever. As a fly fisherman,
oh, sure.
It's something we have to deal with a lot here in the Northeast. So most of the guys I know have gone through bouts of it. I luckily have not, and I just want to try and avoid it. So if the doctor can answer that, and also would there need to be multiple vaccines given the fact that there are multiple kinds of tick disease illness? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. So some fascinating questions there for you, Dr. Danta.
Yes, thank you for the question. There was a vaccine that came out a number of years ago now, and it was effective, but it created a problem, and the reason for that was unclear.
So, Dr. Danta, let's just wait a second. Let that phone finish ringing because it's kind of drowning you out.
I just took care of that.
Awesome.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's okay.
But that vaccine then caused some side effects in some people, and so it was withdrawn. There is a vaccine that was developed for dogs that I was hoping would be introduced for people that is now quite effective, a recombinant DNA type of the vaccine, and there is another vaccine that's being looked at out of Austria, and hopefully it will come to fruition in the next couple of years. But it's not here now, and people are leery that they might get side effects.
But we're not like 50 years out. There is some vaccine technology that's at least in development.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other thing that I wanted to ask you were talking about those symptoms, how hard it can be to test. There are a couple of things I want to ask there. You're probably aware of some new research out of Tufts University that is on a new way to detect Lyme in patients sooner. It relies on something I don't know about called phospholipids. Are you familiar with the new search? And my understanding is if we could test sooner, that would make a bigger difference because you can hit that course of antibiotics sooner and get this thing taken care of.
Yeah. Well, there are two aspects. First of all, that was a nicely done research. And really what it does is show that the reaction by the body to this certain lipid, this certain fat of the bacteria occurs fairly early. But really, I think that blood work, when done early as well, is likely to show a response in most people, but not in all people. nonetheless, I think that research needs to see if it's going to evolve into a practical application. The problem with that research and the existing, and that finding, and the existing tests, they were all indirect tests. They rely on the body's reaction to the components of the bacteria. What we need is what I call a direct detection test, the ability to find one of the components of the bacteria, be it the DNA or, and once the bacteria are established in a few weeks, you can't find anything in the blood or the urine or spinal fluid. So whatever bacteria are present are not readily accessible for testing.
So let me see if I can.
All these tests are indirect. Nonetheless, we need a more direct test. So, one might hope that this research does help to some degree. The earlier, the better in terms of successful treatment.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is right now we can, after your body started to build up a response, we can eventually see the response. But what we can't see is the bacteria quick and early to test it directly, right?
Well, you can find them more readily earlier in the illness within a few weeks. After that, the body's immune system seems to be subverted by the bacteria. They block the response from early antibody to persistent antibody formation. So these bacteria have a very clever way of blocking the immune response and then settling in and being like a parasite, resting, taking nutrition from the body to survive.
Let's hear from Lauren in Stowe. Lauren, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just was calling to share that my family over the winter, we accidentally left our door open while we went out at night, and we came home to find an opossum in our playroom, which was a big surprise. But it led me to do some reading on opossums, and I read that they can eat up to 5,000 ticks a year. So we ended up actually building a little home for the opossum in our backyard. I just thought that they'd get a bad rap, so that would be a good thing to share.
I just also like the idea of the little opossum house in the backyard. So, Dr. Donta, that is a prevention method. What are the prevention methods? I mean, I think probably people hearing about these sneaky symptoms and the parasite in your body for a long time, this is putting the fear of God into folks. So how do you keep this from happening to you?
Well, I think that around your house, the grass should be kept reasonably short, as these bacteria are sensitive to heat and sun. But people just need to be careful if they're going on trails, that the trails be short enough, wide enough, that they can avoid the ticks who can really motor very quickly. But the birds can bring it to the plantings around the house. One just has to be aware if anything unusual happens to them and they have these symptoms that usually they say, oh, I've just been working too hard. As far as prevention, Mr. Keene also mentioned that there are clothing, or you can treat your clothing yourself with permethrin. And
is that
will
a chemical?
Last for a few cycles of washing, and that is helpful. So there are products out there to help you prevent the disease.
So a couple of other questions for you, Dr. Donta. As we're talking about this, of course, we're talking about this in the context of a two-year pandemic with symptoms that can look like lots of things. Is it harder to detect Lyme disease in an era where COVID has such a broad range of symptoms, or are they really sufficiently different that one's not complicating the other?
I think that's a very important point now, and it's being called long COVID. And I think that's bringing attention to that people can have persisting Lyme disease, the cause of which remains to be determined. Unfortunately, though, there were a number of what I call early experts who declared, well, I can't find it, therefore you can't have it. And it's not where you're looking. And the problem is, again, we need a better detection system or an awareness. When somebody comes into the office, the practitioner, and they say they're tired, the practitioner needs to be aware that with rare exception, that a person isn't going to come to office to complain of being tired unless it's unusual for that person. So they need to listen up. And they need to be aware that there are a number of syndromes that are chronic fatigue-like in nature that are difficult to diagnose. As far as the COVID-19 and having persisting symptoms, there are a number of cases that have been reported that these people actually have reactivation of their Lyme disease.
The COVID causes reactivation?
This can happen in people who have ongoing, let's say, milder cases of Lyme disease, even though they might continue to have some fatigue, some aches that they're attributing to whatever else that might be due to Lyme disease. And when they're confronted with a stress, such as an illness like COVID-19, or even the vaccine itself, it might activate the underlying Lyme disease to become more evident.
So Dr. Donta, before we let you go, and we are low on time, but you just implied, and I want to be clear about this because we've talked a lot about the importance of getting vaccinated for COVID-19 on the show. Did you just imply that getting vaccinated could trigger latent Lyme disease in a person?
I don't think there's any real evidence out there for it. So I certainly don't want to dissuade the importance of getting the COVID booster. And if for some reason somebody continues to have or has symptoms that then emerge that are like fatigue in nature, that needs to be tweezed out, dissected out. And one needs to be careful that one doesn't blame the COVID vaccine or the illness itself on reactivating another process. But if that happens, and I'm not sure how often that might happen, but I'm prepared to believe that that can happen, but that by no means should keep people from getting the COVID-19 vaccine, because without that, that can kill you. Lyme, unless in like Mr. Keene's case, if he hadn't recognized that, he could have died from the complete heart block. But other than that, Lyme patients, this is not a fatal disease.
Thank you. That's Dr. Sam Donta, retired University of Connecticut professor of medicine and infectious diseases and a Boston Medical Center clinician specializing in Lyme disease research. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to Route 1 in Saugus, where Kowloon Restaurant is set to undergo a facelift. That's after the break. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston.
40 years ago, that interstate down there didn't exist. Back then, cars came across the country a whole different way.
How do you mean?
Well, the road didn't cut through the land like that interstate. It moved with the land, you know? It rose, it fell, it curved. Cars didn't drive on it to make great time. They drove on it to have a great time.
The voice of Bonnie Hunt there is Sally Carrera talking to Owen Williams, Lightning McQueen, from the 2006 movie Cars. They're reflecting on Route 66. It runs from Illinois to California, but here in Northeast, we have our own. It's Route 1, and it is the longest north to south road in the U.S. Starts up in Kent, Maine, ends in Key West, Florida. And a portion of it runs through Saugus. You may know, in its heyday day, we had neon, flashing signs peppered the road. People drove from around the region to eat and drink and be entertained along that stretch. Part of the culture was Kowloon Restaurant. For decades, it was the spot for good food and scorpion bowls. But now the karaoke hub is changing alongside Route 1, the route it calls home. With us now, Bobby Wong, co-owner of Kowloon. Bobby, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Bobby, what is your earliest memory of Kowloon?
My earliest memories, it definitely was a lot smaller. It was, my parents had taken it over from my grandparents. My grandparents had started it in 1950 with about 30 or 40 seats. My parents took it over in 1958. And my earliest memories was being really young, and my parents, naturally, we didn't have a lot of babysitters, and they would take my family, my siblings, and myself to the restaurant while they were working. And a lot of days that would happen. And I remember just being at the restaurant with my siblings and trying to entertain ourselves while they were working. And in some cases, me and my brother would throw a we wouldn't throw a baseball around because we wouldn't want to break anything, but we'd had roll up the socks or something like that and play catch with it while my parents worked and hopefully stayed out of the way, which more often than not probably what didn't happen, but they were really kind to us in terms of putting up with all of that. So
Bobby,
that's the earliest memory.
That really underscores that Kowloon was a family affair as well as one of these big, beloved, larger-than-life businesses, restaurants on Route 1. You know, we had the giant orange cactus with the Hilltop Steakhouse, for example. There's the famous big dinosaur, which is still there, although the business behind it isn't. Things are changing now. And so you and your siblings who now have grandkids of your own, it's not a future where they're going to be throwing socks around in a giant, giant restaurant anymore. Is that right?
That's right. Things really have changed from the time that I first started working there and just visiting there, and the buildings have come and gone. Institutions like the Hilltop Steakhouse, which was probably one of the most busiest restaurants in the country at one point, they've come and gone. There used to be a Valley Steakhouse. So many different restaurants that I can't keep track of. Augustine's, which was a big Italian restaurant. And nothing seems to last forever, and that's apparently that's the way life is. So right now we're in the midst of trying to figure out what we want to do for the rest of our lives, and whether it's going to be in it won't be in a large restaurant, but, you know, we're getting at that age and where it's demanding, and we see change coming in the future.
So there have been reports that you're going to tear down the big restaurant, build something smaller, create some mixed-use opportunity on the site. Is that the direction you're going?
Definitely. We have a great team that we put together. Everybody always looks at an exit strategy, and the only way I can think of it as it's not a total exit. It's going to be one foot in, one foot out type of situation where we'd like to downsize the restaurant part of the operation, but maybe venture into a partnership with a great developer that we know, Michael Touchette, and, do other income streams such as apartments, and hopefully that would be handed down to the next generation.
And are you at peace with that? I mean, times do change. And it was a big, big restaurant. I know that's not where we are today, especially post-pandemic. Are you at peace?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. If you asked me 20 years ago, I wouldn't even think about it. And I would be kind of struggling with not having to go to the restaurant every day and do what we do. But definitely at peace now where, I know this can't go on. I can't keep doing this forever as well as my siblings. None of us can keep doing it forever. So we don't want to wake up one day. If we didn't start planning and we wake up one day and realize that we have a 1,200 seat restaurant and none of us want to work in it and don't want to go in anymore, what are you going to do? So what we're doing now is putting out, planting the seeds for what happens. And because we're doing it now, we're able to do it in a controlled, timely fashion where we're not racing against the clock or anything like that. And we know it's a long process. We just got permission from a special permit to actually go from 55 foot in height to 67 and 8 inches or something like that. So we got the special permit. The town of Saugus was really gracious and worked well with us together along with our neighbors. And we would get that passed. And now the next step is going to be even probably a lot more work where we get to finally put things on paper and get the permits from the planning board.
Well,
and we'd like to work well together with them, and hopefully it works well.
All right. Bobby Wong, co-owner of Kowloon, will be watching as that progresses, and we wish you luck, Bobby. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So Kowloon is one presence on Route 1. We want to look at the route kind of writ large. Grant Welker is joining us. Grant's been following the changes on Route 1 and the changes for Kowloon. He's a projects reporter with the Boston Business Journal. Grant, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And I appreciate, as the father of a two-year-old boy, you leading with that line from Pixar, Cars, sends me back. I've seen that movie more times than I can count, but it's so appropriate.
Yeah, it did kind of feel like a match. We'll go out at the end of the segment with a little more from the movie. reactions to what you just heard from Bobby and how that gels with what you're watching unfold on Route 1, Grant.
What's going on with Kowloon these days really is, it's kind of a two-part story in some ways, the two elements of both a family business, something that can be very challenging to bring from one generation to the next. Bobby was talking about looking ahead, and he used the term of kind of an exit strategy. And it's the central place in a community, in a region's identity that a place like Kowloon has. It's so central to the cities and towns just north of Boston. So many reunions and anniversaries and communions and bar mitzvahs and so many more have been held there for generations. It makes perfect sense why its potential, not even demise, it's not even closing, but just the fact that it would be drastically changing is really resonating with people.
And much is changing along Route 1, especially as we seem to be moving a little away from the car-centric society to more walkable. People are, after the last couple of years, especially dining, you know, take out more than in a restaurant. Are you seeing massive changes on Route 1, and what direction do you think it's heading?
There have been so many changes, and you mentioned them. I think so many people think of Hilltop Steakhouse, and yes, you do see the neon cactus still there. Of course, now it's standing over a mixed-use development with a bunch of smaller retailers and a series of apartment buildings. You have the dinosaur, the orange dinosaur from the former mini golf, and that too is with a mixed-use development. And these are denser projects. They are less from that auto-centric era, and I think it's really telling. It's kind of funny that another relic of Hilltop is the old, I don't know if they're made out of plexiglass, but the old cows that used to be there that you kids can sit on and play with, they're now at Market Street in Linfield, where those types of projects, like if you look at Route 1, this stretch of around in and around Saugus, you have Market Street and Linfield kind of on one end, you have Assembly Row and Somerville roughly on the other. And these are more the new era of shopping and spending time. They're mixed-use developments, so they have restaurants, they have apartments, they have offices, they have all sorts of different things to do. And it's not along a busy, loud stretch of road like Route 1 that really was very much of its era, mid-century. And that's as busy as Kowloon still often is, that's not the way that we tend to shop or spend our time these days.
So in our last minute or so, do you imagine, especially, you know, Route 1, you can go a long time before you can even turn around, right? And it's a very busy road. Do you imagine that this transformation is possible there?
It's hard to imagine that there won't be continued transformation like this, where you look at Kowloon, and as packed as its parking lot may be, it is just a huge parking lot. And that's not really the Route 1 of what we're facing these days. I think there's going to be a lot more transformation like this. Just down the street, there's Square One Mall that has really fallen on hard times. And whether it's that location or others, there's so much value in these properties, and to think that there's not going to be a lot more of these, it certainly will be, and it will look like these newer developments. It won't look, unfortunately, or for better or worse, it won't look like these ones from a couple of generations ago.
All right. Well, Grant Welker is projects reporter with the Boston Business Journal. I know you've been kind of following the progress on Route 1. Grant, we are interested in following it too. I appreciate you joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
So imagine this. It is nighttime along the New England coast, and a spiny 10-legged creature, 450 million years old, comes crawling out of the ocean to mate, then another and another. Human hunters are there to meet them, to drain them of valuable blue blood, which the humans need for medicines to help keep their fragile bodies alive. This is not science fiction. It is today. These are horseshoe crabs, and the industry surrounding their valuable blood has taken on new significance amidst the race for coronavirus vaccines and other health treatments. It is a fascinating story. We wanted to revisit a conversation that we had about it with the guy who wrote the book on them, literally. Ipswich-based science writer Bill Sargent is an expert on horseshoe crabs and the author of 27 books, including Crab Wars, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Ecology, and Human Health. We talked with Sargent last fall as booster shots were becoming available, and he started by talking about just how cool, scientifically speaking, of course, horseshoe crabs really are.
Horseshoe crabs look like something that Steven Spielberg would have designed for his stormtroopers. But there are two things that are of interest to horseshoe crabs for scientists. And one are their eyes. They have nine eyes in all. And most of what we know about human vision comes from research on the optic nerve of the horseshoe crabs that run from their two compound eyes to their brain. And their brain lies in a circle around their mouths. So these guys actually eat through their brains. I don't know if you do that.
I do about not.
Three times a day. But the other thing, of course, about that's of interest about horseshoe crabs is that blue copper-based blood. And anything that's going to come in contact with the human blood system has to be checked to make sure that it's free of pyrogens. And the way we do that is we use the horseshoe crab blood. And so there's a whole industry that's been built up. Each horseshoe crab is worth about $1,500. So there's not only a very advanced biotech industry, but there's a basic fisheries that is similar to what could have happened in the 1700s, where people simply go out and catch the crabs very carefully, you know, and then they're bled in the laboratory, and theoretically they're returned back to the wild with no mortality. Often what happens under industrial conditions is the trucks won't show up and the horseshoe crabs will stay out in the sun and you'll get very high mortality.
So I want to break a bunch of that down. So first, in case listeners aren't completely clear on this, if it gets injected into your blood as a medicine, it's got to be tested for bacteria. And it turns out that basically, Bill, everyone uses horseshoe crab blood to do that test.
So all your listeners, you know, millions and millions of people's lives have been protected by horseshoe crab blood.
Okay.
And right now, they are sort of the unsung heroes of COVID. You know, we've all heard of Anthony Fauci and we've heard of Francis Collins, but it's really horseshoe crabs that have been protecting us from gram-negative bacteria.
And the idea is that this is a sustainable model, Bill, if the crabs are bled, so literally captured in some of their blood taken out and turned into this product that's used for testing and then put back into the wild. That's the next thing, right?
Right. But it always doesn't happen that way. You know, again, under industrial conditions, something will happen. There'll be a screw up. The truck won't show up. The horseshoe crabs are left out in the sun, and you'll get very high mortality, up to 50% mortality. The companies admit to 15% mortality now, which makes me think it's probably on average about 30%.
And New England is rich in horseshoe crabs.
That's right. And we use them primarily for these biomedical purposes. There's also a small bait fishery. So people will use them for catching eels and for conch to make scungili. What happens now is that if you keep the crabs alive and use them for biomedical purposes, each crab is worth $1,500. If you chop them up and use them for bait, they're worth about 30 cents a pound. But unfortunately, what we're doing is we're using them for bait. There's one state, South Carolina, that has made it illegal to use horseshoe crabs for bait. And so you can only use them for biomedical purposes. And I think all the other states should follow their lead. When I first started talking about this, I'd go on radio programs and I'd take callers. And I thought I was going to get a lot of feedback from fishermen who didn't want to be told what they could use for bait. And they said, no, it's not a problem. There are plenty of other species they could use. Spider crabs work just as well as horseshoe crabs. So they really don't have a problem with it. We have a screwy regulation in Massachusetts, and they call it rent-a-crab. The fishermen will go out and collect the crabs, sell them to the companies to be bled for the lysate, and then they turn around and the crabs are given back to the fishermen to use for bait. So what you're doing is you're taking what should be, you know, 100% sustainable fisheries into 100% unsustainable fisheries.
All right. So
nobody's been able to explain the logic of that to me.
Okay. So there's a bunch of stuff in there. First, I just want to, what is spongili, or the conch and eel thing?
Scungili, you make from the, you have to have an Italian heritage to understand.
I do, but I still don't know what it is. But it's a food.
They take the meat of a conch and then you slice it up very finely and fry it up and make scungili. It's wonderful.
Okay, so this is fascinating for a number of reasons. And as I read the book, here's a couple of things that I kept thinking about. All right, so you have this delicate balance of a 450-year-old creature that nobody really knows about, and no offense to the horseshoe crab, or cares about because they don't know about it, that if we don't maintain it, we don't have the next COVID vaccine, basically. You've got two industries coming at that creature, right? You've got a pharmaceutical industry coming at it with, as you're saying, lax practices that run the risk of depleting the supply. Although, as I understand it, that supply is okay right now. And then you've got the fishing industry coming at it. Is there an ecological dimension to this as well? You talk about that in the book. Horseshoe crabs are important for humans, but they're also in a food chain. Talk about that.
Well, they're absolutely in the center of you could actually call it a food web because it's so complex, but they are a keystone species that all kinds of other species depend on for their existence. The most well-known one are the red knots, which are shorebirds that migrate all the way from Tierra del Fuego in the tip of South America all the way up to the Arctic Circle, where they nest and lay their eggs. And what they do, they've evolved this over millions and millions of years, that they time their migration so they're on the beach, the Delaware beaches, the beaches of Delaware Bay, during the full moon high tides. So they're there for about 2 weeks, and they eat 40 tons of horseshoe crab eggs. And that gives them the fuel they need to make the next leg of their migration up to the Arctic Circle. So if you don't have the horseshoe crabs, and the horseshoe crabs are declining up and down the East Coast, and they're declining in the Delaware Bay area, then you're interfering with this. And they're already seeing that there's a lot fewer red knots, and there's also there when they arrive above the Arctic Circle, they don't have enough fat basically to be able to start laying their eggs.
So there really is a chain reaction here. Now, interestingly, before the horseshoe crabs became central to my ability to get the Pfizer booster that I got in my left shoulder on Monday night, it was bunnies. It used to be that we used groups and groups and groups of rabbits to provide for this testing. Now we use horseshoe crabs. What's next? There's a synthetic version of this that could come along that would preserve this ecology, right?
That's right. There was a scientist in Singapore, and she came up with a way of using, essentially it was CRISPR technology, gene splicing technology, to develop an artificial form of lysate that you wouldn't have to use the live horseshoe crabs for.
Lysate being what's in the blood product. Sorry, we just hadn't used that word yet, Bill. So sorry, go ahead.
What we found is that it isn't as sensitive and it's more expensive and it's harder to use than the natural form of lysate. And I seldom agree with the Food and Drug Administration, but they made the decision not to approve the artificial form of lysate in the midst of a pandemic. They didn't want to switch horses in midstream, as it were. And I have to agree with them, because we have about 30 years of solid data where we know that the natural form of lysate works particularly well, but we only have a couple years of trials with the artificial form. So I think what's happening is that the companies realize that eventually it will be approved. So what they're doing now is they're kind of cutting some corners. We've seen some evidence on Cape Cod that they're actually collecting the crabs in the shallow waters when they're mating. And essentially what you're doing then is you're taking the female horseshoe crabs out of the breeding population, so you're not getting the next generation of crabs. What we've done for a number of years is we have we set out a 100-meter transect, a line along the shore, and you just simply walk along that line and count the number of horseshoe crabs. Formerly, you'd get hundreds and hundreds of horseshoe. You might get between 200 and 300 horseshoe crabs. I was down there about a month ago, and there were only two in a 100-meter transect, which indicates to me what they're doing is that they're collecting them in the shallow waters, and probably they're collecting them in the shallow waters of the Cape Cod National Seashore, which is actually illegal.
But you don't, I got to be clear, because we are a news program. You don't know this. This is what you think is happening.
Exactly. Exactly. It's, I think it's fairly robust, but this is the way you collect data.
Yep.
And we've been collecting it for many, many years. I can't say absolutely that that's the case, but we saw this before in the year 2000 when there was a federal court case. And what was happening is that the Cape Cod National Seashore didn't realize it, but people had been collecting the horseshoe crabs in their waters for the last 20 years. So it was quite embarrassing to the seashore. And what they did is it was a federal court case, and they finally agreed with the Cape Cod National Seashore that they had jurisdiction over the crabs.
So we could be back there
again. And they could uphold
again.
The ban against the crabs.
That was Ipswich-based science writer Bill Sargent. Bill joined us back in November of 2021 to talk about horseshoe crabs and their significant impact on scientific research. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tune in again tomorrow for more. Thanks.